it called the assassination of Semerabuda, and so did Reporters Without Borders also included his killing in a filing with the ICC, war crimes against journalists killed in Gaza. So, you know, the world should be outraged about this killing, about all the killings that are happening to Palestinians, Palestinian journalists in Gaza.
So, Sharif, in this particular case, there is no doubt that the highest echelons of the Israeli Defense Forces were aware that this journalist was wounded and in need of medical attention.
Yes, we have multiple journalists who told. We have screenshots of a WhatsApp group where they're discussing having spoken to Israeli military spokespeople in those hours and saying no approval yet. Ambulance is not cleared. A bulldozer is not cleared yet. So this took hours. And, you know, the Israeli military must have known very early on what the situation is. They're the ones who had repeatedly bombed the area. They knew there was rubble in the streets. There's constant, near-constant drone surveillance of Gaza. The Red Cross, we know, was liaising with the Israeli military to try and get approval. And yet they left, or they just didn't allow, by some accounts, firstly, ambulances were fired on that tried to reach Semerabuda. They returned back. This is the Palestinian Red Crescent and Civil Defense. And they were waiting then for approval. They also asked for Red Cross teams to accompany them to the area as a form of protection. And all of this is happening while Semerabuda is lying helpless. The Israeli military is not giving permission. And he eventually died.
And then, again, that was Wael al-Dadu's camera person and dear colleague who bleeds to death over 5 hours. And then in the last weeks, his son, Hamza al-Dadu, also an Al Jazeera journalist, is killed in this Israeli airstrike, along with the AFP stringer, Mustafa Thoraya, in an airstrike, a drone strike on a car. Sharif, final comments.
Yeah, I think, look, in this country, the journalistic community should be outraged, should be vocal in their outrage at Israel's killing of their colleagues in Gaza, and we haven't seen that. And let me just end by saying, you know, in 2022, the Pulitzer Board awarded a special citation to journalists of Ukraine for their coverage of the Russian invasion and of the war. And the citation reads, quote, "Despite bombardment, abductions, occupation, and even deaths in their ranks, they have persisted in their effort to provide an accurate picture of a terrible reality," end quote. This is the case many times over for the journalists of Gaza, for the Palestinian journalists of Gaza. I doubt they will be receiving any such accolades, and that's where the problem lies.
Sharif Abdelkaddous, independent journalist, wrote this piece for The Intercept. Israel bombed an Al Jazeera cameraman and blocked evacuation efforts as he bled to death. We'll link to it at The Intercept at democracynow.org. And Sharif Mansour, Committee to Protect Journalists, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator, speaking to us from D.C. Next up, we look at what Israelis see on television. Stay with us. ينقص في سلاح بحري يقتل حيوانات بشري تلك قضية وتلك قضية كيف تكون ملاكا أبيض يبقى ضميرك نص ضمير تنصف حركات الحرية وتنسف حركات التحرير وتوزع عطفك وحنانك عالمقتول حسب الجنسية وتلك قضية وتلك قضية كيف تكون إنسانا راق ومطابق للاشتراطات Telka Kadaya. This is an issue by Kairoki. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. From coverage of the war by Palestinian journalists on the ground, we turn to coverage by the Israeli media. What do most Israelis see on TV? How has the Israeli media's coverage shaped opinions of war? This is a clip from I-24 News of Israeli military commander Lieutenant Colonel Dotan talking about an alleged Hamas tunnel in an exclusive video shown by the network last week.
The IDF has found tunnels and weapons inside a child's room inside the Gaza Strip. These visuals were obtained from the IDF. And I-24 News is now going to be allowed to play that. Let's take a look.
During our patrols in the area, we uncovered the entrance to a tunnel under this children's bedroom, actually under this desk, exactly where the children were supposed to study. We can see very clearly the tunnel which goes towards the tunnel gallery. We can also see here these RPG missiles, these munitions grouped in the same sector, including military tactical vests and grenades ready for use.
That was a clip from Israeli media outlet I-24 News. For more on Israeli media's coverage of the war, we go to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece headlined, "If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it?" Gideon, welcome back to Democracy Now! talk about what Israelis see on television, where most get their news. We just did this whole piece on the killing of Gazan journalists, Palestinian journalists. We've never seen anything like this anywhere in modern history, where you have between 80 and over 100 Palestinian journalists killed in just a matter of weeks. What do Israelis understand is happening?
The main question, Amy, is what they don't see or what they are not being shown. Because as you know, and as your viewers definitely know, Israeli media is quite a free media, commercial owned, quite liberal, no pressure from the government or secret services or army or things like this. Anything it does voluntarily. And the Israeli media decided almost wall to wall, maybe except of my newspaper, Haaretz, all the rest, it's not only TV, also newspapers. They decided that they are part of the Israeli propaganda machinery. They stop being journalists. And this they do in two ways. The first one is the most serious one. They don't show Gaza. The Israeli average viewer doesn't see Gaza at all. He sees the soldiers. He sees the families of the hostages. He's being told day and night about the Israeli sacrifice. He's being told day and night how brave are the soldiers. You see it 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and only one thing you don't see, the suffer of Gaza. And the media decided not to show it, not because anyone pushed the media not to do it. They do it because they know very clear that this is what their viewers don't want to see. And they want to please them. And by this, they are betraying our first mission to tell the full story. You know, there are Israelis who wouldn't care less to see all those terrible images and say Hamas is to be blamed, the Arabs are to be blamed, they deserve it, they are barbarian, everything is fine. But they have to see what is being done on our behalf. So that's the first level. The second level, which is less important, but still must be mentioned, is that Israeli media speaks now only in one voice. There is no room for any critic about the war. There is no room for any question marks. I don't remember a war in which, after so many stages, still the entire media is just a pale echo of the propaganda machinery of the army.
Well, Gideon, your newspaper, Haaretz, is somewhat different from the rest of the press, but how widely read is it within Israel, and who reads Haaretz?
Haaretz is not a big newspaper in terms of quantity, but it is still quite an influential newspaper, both abroad, as you know, because it's being published both in English and in Hebrew. And also in Israel, still parts of the elite are reading it. I don't want to say that every Israeli reads Haaretz, but every Israeli knows about Haaretz. And through the social media, it has some kind of influence, but it is obviously very limited.
Can you talk about the levels in Gaza we're hearing about? Of starvation that every Palestinian is hungry right now. The babies being pulled from the rubble. I mean, we're thousands of miles away from you. Tel Aviv is very close to Gaza. What do they see when it comes to casualties?
Nothing. They hear the figures, but figures are only figures. It's only statistics. It doesn't make you feel, it doesn't make you understand the scale of the tragedy, the scale of the crimes, I must say. You know, you watch all the international networks and you see Gaza. You see the children dying on the dirty floors of the hospitals, bleeding to death. You see the uprooted people, you see the destruction, you see the suffer of hundreds of thousands of people, and obviously the starvation. And in Israel, you see only the soldiers, only the families of the hostages, only the scenes where you don't see Palestinians at all. It seems as if they don't exist. Now, Amy, that's not new, because the Israeli media betrayed its mission by covering in the same way the occupations throughout so many years. It was always dehumanizing the Palestinians as much as possible. But this time we reach a level that I don't remember such a level, because you can really watch for hours Israeli TV and have no clue what's going on in Shifa Hospital or in other hospitals or in uprooted neighborhoods. And where are the people? How do they make their living? Do they get some food? Nothing of this. Nothing which might remind us that the Palestinians are human beings. This is almost a taboo. Don't mention them as human beings.
Gideon, Prime Minister Netanyahu keeps assuring the international community that Israel does not intend to permanently occupy Gaza. But what is he saying domestically to the Israeli people? He even has two Twitter handles, one that's an official one, and then another that is more geared toward sending out incendiary messages to the population.
Just this morning, he was quoted in a private talk, I think, that the war will continue at least until 2025. And nobody sees the end. Nobody knows the end. There is no end game. There is no plan what to do the day after. And Israelis start to believe now that this might last for many years, at least the occupation of Gaza, obviously without intention. Almost everything that Israel did in the last decades was without intention, but it always came out. It never intended to go for wars, and it always finds itself in war. It never intended to create an occupation of over 50 years, and it came out like this. No. The intention is one thing, and the results are another thing. Israel has no plan to leave Gaza in the coming months or years, which doesn't mean that Israel will stay there. But I don't see any alternative right now. Where, what will they do?
I wanted to ask you about your paper, Haaretz, reporting that a group of family members of Israelis who were killed in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th in the Hamas attack on Israel are demanding a probe into how their relatives died. An Israeli brigadier general recently admitted he ordered an Israeli tank commander to fire on a home where Hamas fighters were holding 15 Israeli hostages. Brigadier General Barak Haram told the New York Times he'd ordered the tank commander to, quote, break in even at the cost of civilian casualties. 13 of the Israeli hostages died. Only two survived. Gideon, you're a member of the Haaretz editorial board, which recently ran a piece headlined, "The IDF must investigate the Kibbutz Be'eri tank fire incident right now." Elaborate on what happened on the investigation your editorial board is calling for now.
Look, everyone is postponing all the investigation to the day after, and the day after seems to get farther and farther, and we are very concerned that it will never be investigated. But here we have a very concrete case, and families, rightly so, want to know who is responsible for the killing of their beloved ones and how did it happen. The Brigadier General that you just mentioned happened to be a settler. I don't want to say that it says a lot, but let's remember that many of our high-ranked generals, or more and more of them, are settlers, and settlers have their own ideology, even when they serve in the army. They have their own motivation, which is not always a very secular motivation. It's not always the motivation of the others. But in any case, the fact is that those people were killed and might have been rescued. It must be investigated. It's not very complicated to investigate it. It's a very concrete and focused event, and we were calling the army to do so. I don't know. Until now, we didn't hear from the army. I hope they will do it, because this can have also a lot of consequences in the coming days or weeks or months in Gaza, because this situation might repeat itself when we will face a house where there are hostages and commanders of Hamas. Do we shoot them all dead? I really wonder.
And you also had a piece on how sexism ultimately killed what are known as the spotters, the Israeli military, the women who were on the border, who were seeing Hamas gear up, were telling their supervisors, it looks like there's about to be an imminent attack. And some were even told if they raise this again, they would be brought up on charge of insubordination. Is that right, Gideon?
Yeah. We had a big story on this, but you know, the small stories might overwhelm or overshadow the big story. Because the big story, finally, there are two huge question marks. A, what happened on the 7th, and how did it happen? Because all those stories get to one conclusion, that there was no army on this day. There was not the most sophisticated intelligence in the world, with all the most sophisticated devices, who knows the color of the underwears of each Palestinian, all of a sudden didn't know anything. After all the money in which was invested there and all the reputation they have. And then came the second question, where was the army after the attack started? No army whatsoever. And above all, the question which bothers me more than anything else, and that's namely, having said what happened on the 7th, as barbaric as it was, whatever it was, there are question marks about certain events on the 7th, but it's very clear that there was an attack, a very aggressive attack. Does this give us Israelis the right to do anything we want after the 7th, forever, without any limits, no legal limits, no moral limits? We can just go and kill and destroy and destruct as much as we wish? That's the main question right now. The event that you mentioned with those soldiers' girls just show how unprepared and unprofessional was the intelligence and the army.
And, of course, most of those young women died. Last question, your biggest piece, if it isn't a genocide in Gaza.
Only two survived. Yeah.
Only two. If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, yeah, then what is it? We just have 30 seconds, Gideon.
Listen, the Israelis don't seem to care that so many innocent Palestinians were killed. They just care how to label it, if it's genocide or not. And I say it doesn't matter what is the legal definition. 24,000 people, most of them innocent people, 60-70% of them women and children, 10,000 children among them. This is enough of a fact that nobody can deny, by the way, to ask ourselves, do we really have the right to do it? What does it tell about us, about our moral standards? And above all, how long will we go on and where are we aiming to? Another 25,000 killed people in Gaza will guarantee more security to Israel? And even if yes, do we have the right to do so?
Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, also a member of the Haaretz editorial board. We'll link to your piece. If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it? Next up, from Iraq to Lebanon to Pakistan to the Red Sea, will Israel's war on Gaza escalate into a full-blown regional conflict? Back in 20 seconds.
You won't be sorry where the worst came from me. Even the ending world will not be waged from me. The future makes my home, it all came from me. Peace and silence dance on parade right here. He never touched my love.
Came from here by Saul Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. From northern Iraq to Lebanon to Pakistan to the Red Sea, an array of strikes and counterstrikes over the last several days are compounding fears that Israel's assault on Gaza could escalate into a full-blown regional war. In just the past few days, the U.S. has carried out strikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen, who have resumed their attacks on container ships in the Red Sea. Iran has struck what it said was an Israeli spy headquarters in the semi-autonomous Kurdish region of northern Iraq, as well as targeting anti-Iran militants in Pakistan and Syria. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, Hezbollah and Israel have escalated the intensity of fighting across the border. For more, we're joined by award-winning journalist Spencer Ackerman, foreign policy columnist for The Nation magazine. His latest piece, Israel's Not Promising to Scale Back Its War. He also publishes the Forever Wars newsletter on Ghost, where his new piece is headlined Iran's Opening Shots and the Logic of Escalation. Welcome back, Spencer, to Democracy Now! Talk about this possibility of a widening war and what you are most concerned about.
Amy, thank you for having me. I think that in my 20-plus years of covering the war on terror, this is the most dangerous moment in for the Middle East that I've seen professionally. You talk about there being the possibility of a full-blown regional conflict. We're at least at half-blown now. Consider what the battlefields are and have been in this conflict. Gaza, obviously the most important one, the most devastating to humanity, where the Palestinians are experiencing what could and probably should be understood as a genocide. But also southern Israel, northern Israel, southern Lebanon, northwestern Syria, Beirut, northeastern Syria, Erbil, Baghdad, southwestern Yemen, the Red Sea, Pakistan as well. This is now a conflict with battlefronts ranging across the region, each of which facing pressure to escalate as their various combatants' objectives are not fully achieved. We shouldn't think that absent an active act of de-escalation, that this won't continue spiraling outward throughout 2024.
And Spencer, this whole idea that we hear almost every day some member of the Biden administration say that they're trying to prevent an escalation of the conflict in the region, when in fact their actions are quite the opposite.
That's right, Juan. We heard the Biden administration say most recently that it was deeply concerned about escalation in Lebanon. Well, just in the last 24 hours, the Israeli Air Force has been bombing southern Lebanon, bombing what it says are Hezbollah positions there. But also the United States has taken direct action, not just in the Red Sea, but also on Yemeni soil itself. Multiple times, three times at least, including most recently yesterday. And as well, recently, it carried out its first drone strike in Baghdad since 2020, which has now strained U.S.-Iraqi relations. So the United States, while it might say that it's seeking to contain the conflict, is caught up in the logic of escalation. And that means we shouldn't give the Biden administration a pass on this. These aren't, you know, automatic gravitational forces. These are the accumulations of choices that Biden and his team are making to involve the U.S. more deeply in this spiraling conflict, all of which could be stopped if the United States used its immense influence over Israel to restrain it or stop it from carrying out its collective punishment of Gaza.
We often hear as well about the axis of resistance, supposedly controlled or financed by Iran, but very little about the axis of empire of the UK, the United States, and Israel in the region. To what degree does this axis have more right to control the affairs of the region than those who are actually from countries there?
Quite well said, Juan. Without ceding any of Iran's claims to regional hegemony, the United States and its allies act as if they are the representatives of the natural and just order of the Middle East and not, in fact, Western impositions upon the aspirations of the citizenry, the people of these countries, to determine their own affairs. And we are seeing that quite starkly, most recently in Yemen, where one of the most war-devastated countries in the Middle East, as a result of not only U.S. strikes against al-Qaeda targets, what the United States says is al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, stemming from something like 15 over the past 15 years, but also a U.S.-backed Saudi and Emirati campaign that lasted 7 years before a ceasefire took hold in 2022 that brought not only famine, but cholera to this country that has been engulfed in a foreign-backed, foreign-sponsored, and foreign-accelerated civil war. Nevertheless, even among people who don't accept the Houthi movement as the legitimate rulers of Yemen, saw massive demonstrations after the United States and its Western allies started bombing Yemen in retaliation for the Houthi attempt to relieve the siege of Gaza. So you really have we really have on full exposure the rejection of U.S. claims to, you know, standing for peace and stability in the region.
Spencer, your piece last week for The Nation is headlined, "Israel's Not Promising to Scale Back Its War," which you wrote partly as a corrective to a New York Times article that claimed that's what Israel is planning. If you could explain this and what it means we just heard Gideon Levy, the Israeli Jewish journalist at Haaretz, talking about this war going on for a year or more.
That's right. Amy, when you listen to what the Israeli government says to its own people, like Gideon mentioned, it talks about a war that will, and this is what Benjamin Netanyahu said over the weekend, will last until victory and no one, not even The Hague, will stop us, which is an incredibly ominous thing to say and probably ought to be tacked on to South Africa's genocide lawsuit. What it says to the Americans, as the Americans are feeling the pressure from its Arab allies in the region, and indeed from President Biden's own supporters in the United States who want to see this war stop, is that, in fact, it's scaling down to lower intensity operations. Or more often, it doesn't say that quite outright. It says it will move away from high intensity operations into what it says is a so-called phase three of its operations in Gaza. So what is phase three? Phase three focuses on southern Gaza. Every day, we are getting reports of casualties from Gaza, civilian casualties in the triple digits. Israel already made something like 1.7, 1.8 million people relocate to southern Gaza. So this war is not, in fact, scaling down. It's moving toward a sustainable path of civilian devastation.
Spencer Ackerman, foreign policy columnist for The Nation magazine, will also publishes the Forever Wars on newsletter on Ghost. We'll link to your pieces at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Now rewind it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.